Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. We are very excited here in Studio A as well as throughout the building because Gregory Maguire is with us. He is an Albany native and is back in the city this weekend to talk about his latest book, Elfie, the coming-of-age story of Elphaba, who becomes the Wicked Witch of the West. Gregory is the New York Times bestselling author of The Wicked Years, a series that includes Wicked, the classic that is the basis for the Tony-winning Broadway musical, and the same name of the major motion picture that is out and now streaming on Hulu and elsewhere, and you can see it wherever you want to. It is a big hit, and as, of course, is the musical that continues to play on Broadway and tour the world. Maguire's other books include Son of a Witch, A Lion Among Men, and Out of Oz. Those are in the Wicked series. There's also a brand new graphic novel adaptation of Wicked, the first in a two-part series featuring these incredible full-color illustrations by Scott Hampton that is just out. Gregory will be participating in the Albany Film Festival at his alma mater, the University at Albany, tomorrow at 10:45 in the Performing Arts Center. As part of the Albany Film Festival, he will be in conversation with the head of the New York State Writers Institute, our good buddy Paul Grondahl, and it's a great pleasure and treat to welcome Gregory Maguire back to the show.
Thank you, Joe. This is now one of my home addresses in Albany since most of my relatives have died or moved on. And, you know, when I come home, I want somebody to recognize me on the front porch. So here you are.
Well, it's a great thrill to always have you on our front porch. I greatly appreciate you coming in and being so close and with us. I was just telling you, this the new book is so great. It's amazing. It's really, really a beautiful story. And I'm curious as to the origin of it, of when you decided, because I mean, there were always moments of a little bit of backstory here and there throughout your novels.
Right.
And the Wicked novels. But here, this is us getting this incredible look at the childhood of Elphaba. And at what point did you say, okay, this is time to tell this?
Well, I'm going to address the elephant in the room, being the question that has been posed to me to my face several times in the past month or so, saying, where is your shame, sir? Are you still trying to milk this cow that has given you so much surcease and get more money out of it just because you have this big budget Hollywood film behind you to bring the character back into
the
public
eye? What's wrong with that?
Well, actually, I'm enough of a Marxist that I can say there's a little bit wrong with that. But in fact, while I'm not indifferent to the fact that I don't mind making money, it just gives me more to spread around when I feel like spreading it. In fact, I had always felt that there were loose ends in the portrayal of Elphaba, the character from Wicked, which you may remember was published 30 years ago, 1995.
Yep.
Now, Joe, I'll tell you, when I sent the manuscript to HarperCollins in 1995, I was required to take out about 5% of the original word count because it was just too long. And one of the things that was recommended was that I take out two or three very, very short scenes about Elphaba's childhood so that, as my editor said, we can get the story from her birth to when she goes to college more quickly. That's where the story really picks up. First part, pardon me, is necessary, and any hero's birth is an important part of their legend, but we have to get her to college and to Galinda more quickly.
Right.
So I took out two or three scraps. I didn't keep them, but I suppose I kept them in my subconscious because about 4 years ago, I'm sure it had to do with the fact that I knew they were putting $175 million into making the first film.
Right.
I thought this little sprig of an idea that I had in childhood and that I nursed into my 30s and finally wrote and published has grown into such an enterprise. It used to be a little fiddle fern in the backyard, and now it's a forest that covers the continent. It is just such a big story that everybody else loves and owns, and it's escaped my particular management. I can't manage the whole continent-wide forest that Wicked has become, which means that I have created intellectual property that is going to outlast me. And the characters that I have created, that I myself have created, not L. Frank Baum, like Madame Morrible and Fiero and Dr. Dillamond, etc., are going to go on and appear in other people's works when I'm dead. In a way, I don't mind that, as long as they go through my lawyers and my estate gets some
sure.
Proper accreditation, fiduciary and otherwise. But in another way, I think somebody eventually is going to say, well, there's this missing 15 years of Elphaba's life between when she was born and when she went to college. What happened? Let's make hay out of that. Well, good for them. I say, get the proper document signed and go ahead for it. But I'm still alive, and she's still in my head. So I want to do it first. Sure, I don't mind if it's a book that sells briskly, but I want to tell her story. I have finally, Joe, come around. I've been in therapy for 30 years. I have finally come around to accepting the fact that Elphaba really is me. I didn't used to say that.
Yeah.
And I finally, I don't know what it is about age. I finally decided to own her, that her intelligence and her passion and her mistakes and her bullheadedness, they really are me. I'm perhaps more polite than she is, and I'm less green. But why not tell her story while I'm still alive to do it?
The subtitle of the novel is A Wicked Childhood. Do you feel you had a wicked childhood?
Oh, no. I had nothing like a wicked childhood. Part of the reason that I wanted to use that subtitle is I wanted to pay court to those of my fans who are musical theater fans.
Well, sure.
Because they will recognize.
Absolutely.
Perhaps I had a wicked childhood. I don't want to be Maria von Trapp or anything, and I no longer have the voice to carry it off. But I did not have a wicked childhood, but I had a childhood. And I have paid attention to childhood my whole life, including right up till right now. To me, there are three significant dates in a child's life. One, of course, is the date of their birth and what happens to the family when they come into it. In this way, Joe and most people who have ever heard me speak before know that I had a hard birth in that my mother died in childbirth.
Right.
So I had a hard beginning, but I don't remember any of it, and I had a very nourishing second family. My father remarried, and I was brought up very well in the Pine Hills area and very happily with six brothers and sisters. So there's that. There's the birth of a writer, birth of a hero, birth of Harry Potter, birth of King Arthur. There's always something going around.
Sure.
I won't mention Bethlehem, but
the big one.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Then there's the second thing at an important moment in a child's life, I think. Those of us who were raised Catholic, which is quite a few people in the Albany area, will remember that we were told in second grade that when we turn seven, we have our moral apparatus firmly screwed into our characters.
Correct.
And we, in the eyes of the church, we are capable of sin by the time we reach seven because we know the difference between right and wrong. Beforehand, we're just kind of muddy. We're just, putzing around.
They'll give us a slide.
Yeah. And there we are. And when my baby brother Joe turned seven, one of his older sisters, lighting the candle for him and smiling broadly, said, "Congratulations, Joe, you're seven. Now you can sin and go to hell." But, the Jesuit said that too. Give me a child at seven and I will, give him to me for 5 years or something like that, and I will have him for life. I will have the child for life. And so what happens to us about that age when our moral capacity begins to vest in us is, I think, really interesting. That's when children become judgy, but it's also when they believe the most strongly in right and wrong. You were talking about David McCullough and
yes.
Right and Wrong before the hour began. And children start that at the age of 7. I think. I really do believe that, whether or not you believe in the concept of sin or punishment. The last thing, the last moment of childhood that is so important to me that you can actually pick out, we all have our various epiphanies, is like the last 6 months before the storm of hormones takes over. For some kids, it's 7th grade or 8th grade. I think it's been creeping down slope a little bit. I used to love to teach, when I would go into classrooms, to teach 4th graders and 5th graders because they could engage themselves academically and morally and socially with the keenest edge of their characters before their characters were ruined by testosterone and everything else that's going to come upon them that basically have to swim through and survive for the next 7 years till they're grown up. I love kids at that age. They are so capable, and they see and are honest in a way that the parents and the teachers who are trying to lead them forward are no longer able to be. Oh, that's so rich. So if I believe all that about childhood, why wouldn't I want to see who Elphaba was at birth and as a young person at 7 and at 14 and follow her along?
Gregory McGuire is our guest on the roundtable this morning, and the new book is Elfie, A Wicked Childhood, which is just out and absolutely beautiful. It has a deluxe edition, and there's this really cool on the spine of it. What is the proper
I'm not sure
wording of that?
I'm not sure. It's a printed design on the page edges, so it riffles as you glance through the book. It makes a colored pattern in your eyes. It's very, very nice. There is a word for the page edge, the three sides of the page edges of a book, but I don't remember what it is.
Yeah,
either.
You just You write them, I sell them, and somebody else figures that out. Okay, so, you saying, relating to Elphaba, and this is, I mean, this is a tough childhood, and this is obviously a child who is, born green, and has a lot of feeling as an outcast.
Right.
And so many of us feel as outcasts. I mean, isn't that part of why it went from a fiddle fern to a forest? Is that we feel that so many of us identify with that?
I do think, Joe, you're right. Early on, when the producers of the musical started realizing they didn't just have a hit on their hand. They had a once-in-a-generation hit on their hands. And they were interviewed. They used to say, a little glibly, but also I think honestly, there's a little bit of Green Girl in all of us.
Right.
And I think that is true. I know very few people who will stand up at a cocktail party and say, oh, I wasn't marginalized. I was the one in the center of the room. I was the one that everybody adored. There are many, many more Elphabas than there are Galindas.
Yes.
In the world. We all feel it. There's no secret that I grew up as a gay boy into a now I'm a married gay man with three grown children. It wasn't easy in Albany to be considering maybe that my emotions were suggesting I was going to end up not being straight in the 70s and the 60s. That was pretty scary. And so while I didn't have a wicked childhood, as you said at the start of the hour, I did have a complicated and a pressurized childhood where I really had to figure out who I was and how to avoid killing myself, frankly, how to avoid suicide, because I could not see a single door through which I could walk. I had to build the door myself.
Did you seriously consider that?
I don't know how serious it is, but I did get a book by Daniel McGuire, no relation, called something like The Ethics of Suicide, and I read it. I was a very religious kid and considered going into ministry as well. And I thought, well, I was raised to be a father, a husband, and a productive citizen in the world, and I can't see how any of this is going to happen. So So what do I do? Maybe I just am not supposed to be here. I did consider it.
Do you still have a relationship with the church?
I do. I'm a practicing Catholic, which means I never go to church.
Right. Well, we're all practicing to someday be a good Catholic, whatever that is.
Exactly. It takes a lot of practice
to be
Catholic.
Does. Yes.
But you identify. I identify as Catholic. I no longer, for many years, I tried to put my belief system into words, and I no longer feel that's necessary because I know it's not possible. I don't swallow dogma whole. I don't swallow dogma at all. But I am culturally Catholic because I was raised for 13 years of Catholic education, and I believe in the basic tenets of Christianity about charity and social justice. And whether it's presented to me as historic fact or as myth doesn't really bother me. I believe that it's a routine for living that works for me.
I mean, I brought up in a very what I will say is strict Catholic family, but it was not that my parents were at all strict, really, but that it was the way of those were the rules.
Yeah,
and
right.
So to you do that's hard to have that leave you.
Oh, it is, and I don't really want it to, and this does not mean that I endorse in any way any of the crimes and sins that the authorities of the Catholic Church have perpetrated upon the world, upon the whole world. I don't endorse that at all, but I do endorse my love of the message of Christ. Now, you asked me a little bit about the book. You remember that Elfie, as a little green child growing up in the backwaters of Oz, is there because her father is a minister.
Right.
He wants to preach to the pagans and to the heathens. He wants to convert them to his idea of what makes sense in a deity. And she is caught between two stools, if you will. Her father is not quite rabid, but he's certainly a dedicated minister and brings his family to a hardship post so that he can satisfy his own needs to be a preacher. And her mother is, in the old-fashioned parlance, a slut. You know, she's kind of a harlot. So talk about, you know, yin and yang. How do you find yourself between the overly good and the rather recklessly sloppy when it comes to moral character?
First of all, the language of the book is absolutely gorgeous. It is. I was saying to you before. I just forgot what a beautiful. Not that I forgot, but you're such a beautiful writer. And this is so on display in this, of the way in chapters that are very short, and yet there is such a sense of where we are and almost I felt as you were taking my hand and guiding me through these early years. And there's a gentleness to this wicked childhood that is fascinating in your telling.
Well, I'm really glad to hear you say that, because to go back 30 years, when I wrote the novel Wicked, I thought I was writing it for geeky, nerdy kids like me who liked things like The Lord of the Rings and The Once and Future King, which was a small segment of the reading population. Mind, this was before Harry Potter. It was before the Peter Jackson films of The Lord of the Rings. So we didn't know that literary fantasy was going to kind of explode.
You were there first.
I was there first. I was there about 18 months before all that broke upon us. So I did not think that I was writing for a large audience. I thought I was writing for the kind of devoted, possibly socially compromised audience of people who preferred to read than to go out to the bars. And I did not make too much effort to cousin my readers. I didn't offer them too much of a handhold. I said, you're in for a penny, you're in for a pound here. This is like War and Peace. You just got to decide you're going to do the whole thing, and you will make your own way and find your way if you want to. You're going to read Proust? Only some people are going to read Proust, but if you do, you're going to read it and you're going to stick with it for the 6 years it takes. That's what I thought. But then Wicked became popular. It came into the world, and despite its length and it's intentionally 19th century orotundity, let's say, it developed a devoted reading audience. In Elfie, I wanted to, as you say, and I like your word, I be more gentle. I wanted to give extend a hand to people who like the story but aren't perhaps as versed in 19th century literary history and tradition. I wanted to make them feel at home. It is, after all, the story of a child. And so as children's attention spans are short, I wanted to speak to the shorter attention spans of the contemporary reading public and make them feel at home and not make them feel that I was looking down on them in any way.
So you can certainly choose, obviously choose not to answer this question, but my spidey senses went up when you used the number 30 twice, once when you said you started therapy and once when you said the book came out.
Oh, yes. Well, that was it. That was kind of a joke, the first one, because what I mean is that when the book came out, it was my therapy. And,
okay.
You know, yeah. And I've been in therapy from time to time, not for 30 years, but occasionally, including here in Albany. But, yes, been out for 30 years. And so during those years, I've had to reconsider why has it hit so hard? Before Broadway got a hold of it, 7 years into its life, it had sold 750,000 copies. This is not what most books do. And it was selling more every half-year reporting season than it had the season before.
I mean,
I just had to ask myself, what is going on here?
I mean, just so most people know, but the average book will have 30,000 to 50,000 copies come out, and good luck if you can sell them.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And then you have something that all of a sudden comes in and grabs hold.
Yeah. Yeah. I did not expect that. I knew that I was pegging my ideas about evil and about scapegoatism to a little Velcro hook of popular culture. I did not know that this is a Velcro hook upon which everybody hangs their passions. I just didn't quite get that. I thought that was just nerdy people like me.
And what you have seen, and I don't think this is overstating at all, but I mean, you have seen the result of, I mean, obviously the source material and the movie, The Wizard of Oz, have been around a lot longer, but you see the same rabidity within the fandom of that within within this story and people who of my generation and younger who say, okay, well, this, you know, Gregory was almost the source material in this.
Well, it's true, and in fact there are a lot of people who have seen and taken on the story of Wicked who have not seen the 1939 film. I didn't think that was possible, but we're just turning that, we're kind of cresting that wave of popular culture where The Wizard of Oz, 1939, it's 85 years old now. It doesn't have the same pull on the current generation as it did when we were kids. And Wicked does. Wicked has taken its place a little bit. I don't think Wicked is as good a story as The Wizard of Oz, and I don't pretend anything other than I built my mansion upon a more wonderful foundation. But there it is. I can't deny it.
I want to make mention before we're talking about Elfie, A Wicked Childhood, which is just out from William Morrow. Also out from William Morrow is Wicked, the graphic novel. This is the first part, part one and part two. It is adapted from your story and illustrated by Scott Hampton, and it is gorgeous.
It is gorgeous. And what I like about it is it's not a graphic novel of the play or of the movie. It's not a comic book version. It's a graphic novel of my novel, and every word in those speech balloons and every word in the bar graphs at the top that say what's going on is taken from my novel. It's my writing. I think maybe I had to rewrite one panel because we wanted to leave something out that that I didn't think would be appropriate for the potentially younger audiences right. that might look at that. And so I said, let's redo that. And then I wrote one more paragraph. But
that is fine, too, because it also gives you the opportunity because the story then is broken up from part one to part two.
Yes, right. Exactly.
Well, Gregory Maguire, you are wonderful. I can't tell you how much I enjoy speaking to you. And I will tell you, I just had our research team do this. You are the first guest we've ever had that used the word orotundity. So I thank you for bringing that to us. I appreciate that. Gregory Maguire's new book is Elfie. He will be at the New York State Writers Institute's Albany Film Festival at the University at Albany tomorrow, 10:45 in the Performing Arts Center Main Theater. You'll be talking to one of the best, Paul Grondahl, who is a dear heart. And I just talked to Paul a few days ago, and he said, oh, my God, isn't that book amazing? I said, yes. Geeking out on how great the book is. So that event is tomorrow. You can find out more by going to albanyfilmfestival.org. You can also go to gregorymaguire.com. You are wonderful. Thank you so much for being with us.
I'm never going to write another book again unless you promise to have me back on the show.
I can't wait.
Thank you.
Invitation is extended.
Thank you, Jeff.
Have a beautiful weekend, everybody. Thanks for being with us. We'll be back on Monday.